What happens when grief becomes so unbearable that you can't speak its name? In September 1974, 14-year-old Paul Hewson, not yet known as Bono, watched his mother Iris collapse at her father's funeral. 3 days later, he heard the sound of a switch, the life support machine being turned off. After that, in their Dublin home on Cedarwood Road, three Irish males, Bono, his brother Norman, and their father Bob, lived in what he calls rage and melancholy, dealing with loss by never mentioning it again. The silence was deafening. When you can't speak about pain, where does it go? For Bono, it poured into music. His songs became prayers, his stage became home, and his voice became the instrument for emotions too raw to articulate in ordinary conversation. This void would shape everything: his desperate search for surrogate families, his lifelong restlessness, and his transformation into one of the most influential musicians and activists of our time. In September 1976, Larry Mullen posted a notice at Mount Temple School: "Drummer seeks musicians to form band." The kitchen rehearsal was chaos, more noise than music. But something clicked. Larry had what Bono calls primal power and beautiful violence. Adam Clayton looked the part and became their first manager, despite barely being able to play. Then there was David Evans, Edge, leaning against a wall with the coolest aura, somehow in tune with himself amid the cacophony. Edge was the minimalist to Bono's maximalist, the silence inside every noise. Their personalities complemented perfectly, though rehearsals were tense. Bono, the least skilled, would scream at his bandmates, perhaps hurting to avoid the hurt. Their third rehearsal space backed onto the graveyard where Bono's mother was buried. During one frustrated session, demanding a sound like an electric drill into your brain, Bono grabbed Edge's guitar. That tension birthed I Will Follow with its repetitive walk-away hook, a song Bono called a suicide note, never consciously connecting it to his mother's nearby grave. As Boy gained traction, U2 faced an existential crisis. The band's involvement with Shalom, a Christian community practicing naive first-century Christian life, created unbearable tension. Their leader, Chris, questioned whether fame contradicted humble service, whether their music distracted from preaching the gospel. Edge couldn't reconcile global success with this calling. One evening, he told Bono he was quitting. Bono responded that if Edge left, he would too. Manager Paul McGinnis found leverage. Would God want them to break a legal contract? They eventually realized their music should reflect who they were, contradictions and all. Their second album, October, emerged from desperation after Bono's lyrics were stolen in Seattle, forcing him to improvise and even sing in Latin on Gloria. Through this struggle, they discovered music's purpose wasn't saving the world, but saving themselves first. Bono developed a faith embracing doubt rather than certainty. Years later, he would write, "I still haven't found what I'm looking for, a pilgrim's progress without a rival." By 1990, despite the Joshua Tree success, Bono sensed vulnerability. On New Year's Eve 1989, he declared, "This is just the end of something for you two. We have to go away and dream it all up again." Arriving in Berlin on October 3, 1990 to record Achtung Baby, they found Hansa Studios overlooking remnants of the Berlin Wall, but the songs weren't there. Cold winter matched growing tension as Adam and Larry questioned abandoning their successful sound, while Bono pushed for reinvention. They were closer to breaking up than since 1982. The breakthrough came with one, emerging from two discarded chord sequences. Bono had recently declined the Dalai Lama's Festival of Oneness invitation, adding one, but not the same, as a postscript, the song's philosophical core. "We don't have to see things the same way to be one. We get to carry each other, not got to." For the Zoo TV tour, Bono created The Fly, a fantastical uber rock star who understood humor as a weapon. Part Dada, part Shakespearean fool, this contrarian court jester liberated him from his earnest persona. The multimedia extravaganza featured televisions covering the stage and East German Trabants hanging above. But flippancy ended when the tour reached Italy, where the Bosnian War revealed genocidal tendencies they thought Europe had banished. In March 1999, Bono arrived at the Oval Office dressed like a cat burglar to pitch President Clinton on Jubilee 2000, a debt cancellation campaign rooted in biblical justice. The campaign had 24 million signatures from 155 countries, but needed American support. Following Eunice Kennedy Shriver's advice, Bono united liberal economist Jeffrey Sachs with conservative Robert Barrow, a strategy he'd employ for 20 years, bridging left and right before positions hardened. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers initially refused to meet a rock star with one name, but eventually backed the initiative. The campaign gained moral authority when Pope John Paul II donned Bono's blue-tinted glasses with a devilish grin, delighting cameras. Days later, Clinton announced complete debt forgiveness for 36 countries. Under President Bush, Bono convinced compassionate conservatives that fighting AIDS aligned with their values, citing 2003 Bible verses about the poor. After Bono handed Bush three ARV pills, the president announced $15 billion for PEPFAR, until COVID-19, the largest health intervention against a single disease in history. Home after a Paris show, Bono wakes overlooking Killiney Beach, where he and Ollie have lived for over 30 years. Gazing at his sleeping wife, he realizes his search has ended. It is you, I am home, no longer in exile. Throughout his memoir, Bono returns to surrender, to music, faith, activism, love. Brian Eno suggests surrender might be the most powerful word in the lexicon. The only true way to be victorious is to surrender to each other, to love, to a higher power. His relationship with Ollie embodies this surrender. They married young at 22 and 21, defying statistics with what Bono calls a grand madness, jumping off a cliff believing we could fly. Through decades of fame and family life, they've evolved from passionate lovers to co-parents to best friends, a lower temperature take on romance that proves enduring. The same surrender applies to U2, whose four members have remained together for over 40 years, becoming some kind of sacrament, the divine signal Bono has been seeking. His journey also required reconciling with his father, Bob, who died in 2001. During a Rolling Stone interview, Jan Wenner surprised him. "Your father deserves an apology." Easter 2002, in a chapel in Aix, France, Bono sat alone and apologized to his father, writing, "Sometimes you can't make it on your own." Bono's journey from Cedarwood Road to global stardom completes a circle of surrender, to the music that saved him, to the bandmates who sustained him, to the wife who grounded him, and to the faith that guided him. The greatest victory comes not from conquering the world, but from surrendering to love.